From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. Coming up on Dialogue, we're continuing our show with the theme of education. Malcolm X once said, "Education is the passport to future, for tomorrow belongs to those who prepare for it today." In 2024, it's unclear if Black students are engaging education that both grows and validates them.
38% of Illinois students didn't have basic reading skills by the fourth grade in 2022, according to the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Black and Hispanic children are even less likely to be proficient than white children.
And we have not been serving our Black children well. We need to interrogate why.
We have students who are rich in culture. They bring tons of value to the building. And a lot of times they don't get to shine their gifts in traditional academic situations.
Those voices were a part of IPM News story, reacting to state reading scores, and former Booker T. Washington principal Jamie Rountree, talking about how lessons aren't always inclusive of Black communities today. Today, we're having a dialogue with Dr. Gloria Ladson Billings. She's a professor from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she's the author of Justice Matters. She's a theorist and teaching educator whose work covers critical race theory, economic opportunity, and educational opportunity. She's helped shape education today. She recently visited the campus of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign for the Teach Academy as a keynote speaker. Teach is an experience focused on educational justice, equity, and inclusion. It's a recurring event that seeks to accelerate learning outcomes for students, especially those from marginalized communities.
So first of all, I'm very honored to be asked to participate in the Academy. I'm one of several keynoters. My work over the past 36 years has really focused on teachers who are successful with African-American students. I hope whenever I get a chance to speak, to get people to kind of flip the switch. And what I mean by that is we typically ask, what's wrong with Black kids? I had the audacity some 36 years ago to ask the question, what's right with them? And what happens in a classroom where teachers and their families and the students get it right? And so that's really been sort of the focus of my work for, three decades.
If you had a list, maybe top three things about how Black children in particular can be supported in public schools, what would be on that list?
Oh, that's an easy question because of my research. Number one, that we need to support their learning, that I'm not as focused on measures of external performance like, quote, state tests, but are kids actually learning? Can we show the growth? What does a kid look like when they come into a classroom in the fall? Versus what they look like when they leave in the spring. The second thing, of course, is that we've got to be able to really support their, what I've called their cultural competence, that they come in with knowledge. They come in knowing things. They come in with an understanding of who they are, and they should not be denigrated, whether it has to do with their language, whether it has to do with traditions and customs, whether it has to do with worldviews. But the schools have an obligation to help them become fluent in at least one other culture. And for Black kids, that's typically what we might call the mainstream culture. Our kids need to be able to do both. But as I said in my presentation, that doesn't let white kids off the hook. They too need to be more culturally competent and be able to interact with and work with people beyond their cultural groups. The third thing is what I've called the socio-political or critical consciousness. What is the point of going to school if you're not able to solve real problems? And certainly in our communities, our kids are faced with many of them. So on the one hand, maybe you're teaching something like in biology with sort of genetic markers, okay? Our kids will want to know, why is the hypertension or blood pressure rate so high among Black people? That is a question worthy of study, and you don't have to be studying smooth and wrinkled peas or, guinea pig hair like they did when I was in biology. So that's those three things, the student learning, the cultural competence, and the political, social, political, or critical consciousness are essential.
How can children in other communities like immigrants, Latinos, Asians, or rural students be supported?
I think if you use those three broad categories, they fit for all of them. We want all of our kids to be supported academically. We want them all to learn. We want all of our kids to feel comfortable in their skin. If their first language is other than English, they shouldn't be ashamed of it. What they should be able to do is bring that to the classroom as they are learning English in this case. But again, I think we do our white kids a disservice when we allow them to graduate from high school being monolingual. They should also be bilingual.
How do you think that parents can support educators or be involved in the classroom when so many are working multiple jobs or they might feel disempowered by public education within their own experience?
So I do a lot of work with parents, and one of the things I try to encourage them to do is be prepared to ask three questions of any teacher that is teaching their child. Many of us have gone to schools and heard how, quote, nice our kids are. You know, oh, he's such a nice boy. My response to that is always, I sent him nice. That's no value added. I sent you a nice kid. The three questions that I need answered are, what is my child able to do? What does my child know and is able to do? What does my child still need to know and be able to do to be successful at this level? And how can I help? If you get those three questions answered, it doesn't mean you have to be running up there every day. It may mean that, you know, your child needs more practice on something. Okay, I can provide that, right?
And with those three questions, you're building a relationship. How do you think an educator and a Black parent can build a relationship and allow it to evolve?
No relationship starts with antagonism, no enduring one. So the very first thing, when I first started teaching, I was taken aback by the fact that my colleagues would send home letters with this long list of expectations on the parent's part. And I asked the question, well, what can parents expect of you? And everybody's, you know, the eyebrows were raised. So I started sending home a letter saying, I'm your child's teacher. I'm delighted to have them in a classroom. Here's what you can expect of me. And I would point out that I'd be there every day, that I was available before school, after school, and, you know, just things like that. And then I always would end the letter with something that said, within the next 2 weeks, you will get a phone call from me just so that I can check in. That initial phone call, and it took me, and I had middle schoolers, so we're talking 150 kids, but it took me Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of a couple months to begin the call. And I had so many parents that I've never had a call that wasn't a complaint. So I was building that relationship so that when something may have gone wrong, I was more trusted because they were like, well, she called and she, in the beginning, and told me how excited she was to have Jamal in the classroom. And so if he's not doing what he's supposed to do, I'm going to listen to her. So we have to work on that. We have to be willing to be in community. We have to be able to be engaged in the institutions that matter in community, whether they are churches or community centers. We have to be in those places.
What would be your advice for someone who might feel disempowered within their own experience to get involved again and engage with these institutions?
I also think we have to move away from thinking everything is about one parent and one kid. Sometimes there are people in the community who are more respected. I think scholar Annette Henry calls them other mothers. We need to figure out who the other mothers are in the community. So if it's Ms. Bertha down the street, that's who we may have to talk to. If it's the pastor, that's who we might have to talk to. Sometimes a person with the authority may be an older sibling, it may be an aunt. We have to figure out what's the network of connections around this youngster. I have heard so many times people talk about, well, kids not successful because they're from a single parent household. That's a cop-out. It is difficult to raise children in this society with two parents. The kids who are successful are surrounded by caring adults. So if you look at middle-class white kids, it's not just mom and dad. It's a soccer coach. It's a piano teacher. It's the art teacher class that they go to. Our job is to surround our kids with as many caring adults as we can. It's why our athletes actually do better than the kids who are not engaged, because there are caring adults around them. There's the coach who takes up a lot of their time. We have to really minimize the space that kids have to rely on peers for answers, because their peers don't know any more than they do.
I hear you talking about this village and the different components it takes to raise a child. What else would you say are key elements to having your village?
I just think kids need the affirmation. They need to hear that I count, you know, I think you can do this. I think you are capable. They need people to cheer them on. And I think if we find ways to ensure that people who care about them can be engaged with them, you know, we live in a very segmented society, so we don't have multi-generational households in the same ways that we used to. In my own family, my kids, my older kids, I have three boys who are close in age, they had the benefit of grandparents. My daughter is the youngest, and there's a big span between her and her brothers. By the time she came along, my mother wasn't in the best of health. My mother-in-law wasn't, so they couldn't engage with her in the same way. And she really missed that opportunity to have a grandparent. It's, you know, one of the joys of my life is I'm a grandparent. And, you know, my kids say, why do you let these kids do whatever they want to do? I said, I don't let them do whatever they want to do. But I have enough distance, you know, to be able to say, listen, let's think about this. Is that a good idea? What do you think your parents would say? So I used to say, and when I was a teacher educator, you know, to treat the kids like they're your children. Now I say, no, treat them like they're your grandchildren. Why? Because grandchildren are perfect. You're going to have to go a long way to convince me that there's something wrong with any of my grandchildren.
What does effective, culturally responsive teaching look like?
It looks a lot like those three things that I talked to you about in the beginning, that there's someone who is vested in kids learning. There's someone who is vested in their cultural competence, that they feel comfortable in their own skin, that they can bring what they know from their own experiences into the classroom to share. And it's someone who's really willing to push kids to problem solve, to raise questions about the way things are. Why is it this way? Why is the school on this side of town have all of these resources and a school on that side of town doesn't have anything? Those are valid questions that we want kids to be able to both ask and answer.
What are the obstacles preventing teachers from implementing that in majority Black classrooms?
A big part of what you see, particularly in majority Black classrooms, is a very stripped down curriculum that is really geared towards they got to pass this test, as opposed to that they get an education, that their minds get engaged. In an earlier session I did a breakout, I talked about a school district in Minnesota that moved totally away from remediation. They said, we're not doing remediation because we have no evidence that it helps. They moved to acceleration. And so all of their kids to graduate from that district must take at least one AP class or one honors class or one college class. Think about it, if each of our kids gets to be on the campus of the University of Illinois for something, doesn't mean they have to take a physics class at Illinois. They could take a dance class because they teach dance here, right? They could take an art class. The idea is to place our kids in environments that show them you belong here and you have every right to be here.
I want to reverse that question now and ask you, what does culturally responsive teaching mean in majority white classrooms?
It means that those white youngsters get an opportunity to see a bigger world. I was very blessed to have had many, many years ago as a professor, a woman who became kind of the dean of children's literature, Dr. Rudine Sims, who is now at Ohio State. I had Rudine at Morgan State. And she said, children need, and young people need, books that are mirrors, windows, and sliding glass doors. And I just love that metaphor. The mirror is that they ought to be able to pick up a book and see themselves. So we know that's a concern for kids of color. White kids do see themselves in the books, but they don't see the windows. The window is seeing outside of yourself. So they need to be able to see a world outside of themselves. And then they need to be able to navigate and transverse those places, the sliding glass doors, to come from where I am to go to where you are. Every white college student that I have taught who is engaged with this work, it's almost like scales fall from their eyes. They say, oh my gosh, I never thought about that. I never considered that. I never even understood the resources that are available in these communities because I was really thinking I was a good person going to do, in some ways, missionary work. When they begin to understand, they get to these places and they're there as learners too. Then they really grow.
You may have heard about the outrage by some over critical race theory. Next, we'll ask Dr. Ladson Billings, what is the difference between CRT and culturally relevant teaching, and how she pushes back on people who conflate the two?
Totally different things. One is about pedagogy. One is about theory. One is what legal scholars use. Critical race theory is an analytic tool. When I have conversations with people who are predisposed to say it's the devil incarnate or something terrible, I never lead with exploring critical race theory. I lead with, tell me how you explain racial inequality in a society. And if their response is there isn't any, then there's no conversation to be had because we don't live in the same world.
You're currently listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Right now, we're having a conversation with Dr. Gloria Ladson Billings. She's a professor from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of Justice Matters. She's currently speaking with us about culturally responsive teaching and the critical race theory. Stay with us after this short break on Dialogue. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. Continuing our dialogue today, we're speaking with Dr. Gloria Ladson Billings. She's a professor from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she's the author of Justice Matters. She's a theorist and teaching educator whose work covers critical race theory, economic opportunity, and educational opportunity. She's helped shape education today. She recently visited the campus of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign for the Teach Academy as a keynote speaker. Teach is an experience focused on educational justice, equity, and inclusion. It's a recurring event that seeks to accelerate learning outcomes for students, especially those from marginalized communities. Right now, we're continuing our dialogue with Dr. Gloria Ladson Billings about critical race theory and culturally responsive teaching in the classrooms.
One is about pedagogy. One is about theory. One is what legal scholars use. Critical race theory is an analytic tool. When I have conversations with people who are predisposed to say it's the devil incarnate or something terrible, I never lead with exploring critical race theory. I lead with, tell me how you explain racial inequality in a society. And if their response is there isn't any, then there's no conversation to be had because we don't live in the same world. But this nation has always had an explanation for inequality. Originally, we said it was biogenetic, that these people don't have the brain capacity, they just don't have what it takes to know how to do certain things. For everything from being college students to being a quarterback on a football team, we said they didn't have the capacity. That kind of fell out of favor, but not before many of our colleges and universities having eugenics programs where we rated and ranked people by race and ethnicity. So that one, as I said, has fallen out of favor somewhere around the mid-20th centuries. And so what you saw in the 1950s was kind of a shift towards the idea that, oh, well, they just don't have equal opportunity. That's what Brown versus Board of Education was about. Let's give them an equal opportunity. That's what affirmative action was about. That's what the civil rights. And so you might say, well, yeah, that's a good explanation, and we just need to give them more opportunity. I don't dispute that. My question is, how come every time we do it, we roll it back? So our kids are more segregated, so where's Brown? The Civil Rights Act has been eviscerated. The Voting Rights Act is no more. Affirmative action has been struck down. So critical race theory for me is the best explanation of inequality. I tell people all the time, it's not my religion. It's the best answer I have right now. If I get a better answer, then I'll move to that answer. But right now, it's in many ways analytically doing the work to explain inequality. And I think we need those tools because we can't just say, we'll just keep doing what we're doing when we see on every major measure of social good, Black folks are down, right? Whether it's education, employment, housing, representation in our very own governments, there is this inequality that exists. And what critical race theory is saying is that it's structural. It's not just the mean white person. I give an example in one of my presentations about my dad being a veteran of World War II. So he's entitled to the GI Bill. When he came home and, you know, settled down, got a job, and wanted to buy his family a house, he was approved for a mortgage at $8,000. Hard to believe that the houses cost that back then, but they did in the 50s. At the same time, Levitt towns were popping up in Philadelphia, in New York, in Maryland, in Ohio. And Levitt towns were these brand new homes that cost, guess what, $8,000. So it seemed like, oh, my father can just go out here and buy this brand new house. No, because Levitt towns had a clause in their covenant, clause 25, that said no person other than a person of the Caucasian race can be a purchaser, an owner, a leaser, or an occupant of a Levitt home. So there's 18,000 homes sitting outside of Philadelphia at that time that no person other than a white person could live in. That's not a mean GI to my dad. That's a system, because how can this man build 18,000 homes outside of Philly, New York, Cleveland, and Baltimore by himself? The federal government is subsidizing this. Now, we ended up living in West Philadelphia. I loved living in West Philadelphia. I love my friends. I love my neighborhood. So someone might say, well, if you were happy where you were, what's your beef? Here's the issue. If today you look up my parents' old home on Zillow or Redfin or one of these things, it's valued at about $93,000. The Levitt home is valued at $565,000. That's the beef, right? Because there's no transfer of wealth to my brother and I from that $8,000 home. But our white peers already have a leg up, so they don't have to go into debt to go to college. I mean, so this is the systemic nature of the racism. Racism is the issue. It is not what, you know, an individual calls you the N-word or puts a noose outside you. That's not really it. It's the way that no matter how hard you are working, you are in a system that will not acknowledge your worth.
Speaking of the current climate, what do you think about the pushback on DEI, and how is this affecting classrooms moving forward?
Well, I'm actually working on an essay, just getting started, in which I'm arguing that CRT was never the issue. It was always DEI. But you couldn't come after DEI at that time because it was popular. So what you do is you demonize something that people don't understand, you know, a pretty obtuse legal theory, get them all scared about that. Then you link DEI to it, and then you destroy DEI. But I will also say that DEI is not without some responsibility in what's happened. Two things I think that folks who work in DEI didn't do well. Number one, they didn't show a whole lot of improvement. So here you have University of Michigan, which has a pretty elaborate DEI setup, but you don't have a whole lot more students of color, right? So what is your warrant for the DEI, right? And then the second thing I think DEI didn't do well is that they did not connect often enough and regularly enough with the research. What is the research telling us? It ended up being about a bunch of activities and, you know, things that we put in place. Because DEI doesn't do anything for people outside of the institution. You know, you got to be in the institution, right? So there's some culpability on that front, but I think the attack was always against how do we get these folks of color out of these positions.
Dr. Gloria Ladson-Billings, thank you so much for having this dialogue with me.
Sure, thank you.
You're currently listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Kennedy Vincent. We just had a dialogue with Dr. Gloria Ladson-Billings. She's a professor from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of Justice Matters. She recently visited the campus of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign for the Teach Academy as a keynote speaker. Her work covers critical race theory, economic opportunity, and a lot of it has shaped education today. Dialogue is now available on all streaming platforms. You can tune in wherever you find your podcasts. As we continue our dialogue, we're going to stay on this topic of education. Right now, we're going to learn about how some parents in rural majority white areas of Illinois are seeing the value of diversity education. When Illinois lawmakers expanded the Black history lessons required to be taught in public schools, part of the goal was building empathy among non-Black students. Chicago Representative LaShawn K. Ford helped pass the law in 2021, and at the time, he said people wanted more education on who Black people were before they were enslaved.
The community felt that if we want to make sure that we treat people right, we should know where they come from.
Most Illinois schools are majority white, and that's especially true in rural areas right now. We're going to learn more about how a teacher tackled race and sexuality in a rural classroom. Illinois Public Media education reporter Emily Hayes shares this story with us on Dialogue Today.
In 5.8 miles, the destination is on your right, Cuba Senior High School.
Cuba, Illinois is in the western part of the state. At one time, there were a lot of mining and factory jobs here. Now the surrounding county's biggest industry is educational and social services. According to the 2020 census, over 1,100 residents live here, and 95% of them are white.
Our population jumped to 2000. It's the only time in a census where we ever got to 2000.
That's Joe Brewer. He teaches history and social science at Cuba's high school.
And then look what happened 10 years later, 1920. We go from 68.5% growth, never seen that before, to all of a sudden 26.5% decline, like in one census.
On this day in mid-March, Brewer is talking his class through the evidence for whether their town was welcoming to African Americans in the 1920s. He shows them notes from James Lowen, one of the country's top experts on sundown towns. These were places where African Americans were warned to leave before nightfall. The census irregularity is what brought him to Cuba.
He wrote this word. This is his conclusion. What are we?
Probable.
Okay, if you're in a like murder trial and you're finding out, did Cameron commit the murder, right? And the jury comes back and they says, probable. He probably did.
Lowen has since passed away, but others have picked up where he left off, including former Southern Illinois University sociology professor Jessica Crow. She says some sundown towns drove out existing Black residents and others set up formal or informal laws warning new Black migrants from the South not to settle in.
People who live there still remember the signs that were posted on the edge of the town's city limits. And these signs would say different things, but they all had the same theme where they would, you know, say that the racial group, do not let the sun set down on your head in this town.
Crow grew up in a documented sundown town, Pena, Illinois, where five Black miners were killed in riots in 1899 and other Black residents were expelled. The town is still 97% white, and she barely learned about race in school.
You know, you go to college and you're like, oh gosh, there's all these people that are not white, right? And it's like, how do I interact in that social setting? Like, how do I not offend people, right? And I made some big mistakes.
Crow says she used words no one had ever told her were offensive. She corrected her mistake afterwards, but wishes she had learned more when she was younger. So is the assumption behind Illinois' laws mandating more inclusive history right? Can education prevent racism? Canadian psychology professor Elora Dannon-Efimoff says yes. She published a study last year on experiments conducted with introduction to psychology students.
We found that, you know, any type of learning was better than no learning.
Over the span of a few months, the students did show more knowledge about Indigenous people and were more empathetic towards them. At least in Canada, she says learning about racism as a system that advantages white people over Indigenous people worked better over time than learning about racism as a negative bias against a group of people.
We're centralizing racism within a person as something, you know, abnormal about that person who holds racist attitudes or racist beliefs. So that helps us to kind of ignore the system. And it also helps participants to go, well, I'm not racist.
But over time, participants did forget some of the knowledge they had learned and lost some of the empathy they had gained. Efimoff says long-term learning, like lessons over multiple years in school, is necessary to prevent that loss. That's why Joe Brewer has high hopes for his students.
Democracy should be born anew in each generation. What do they want school to look like? What do they want these communities that are really struggling, that are aging? What do they want these communities to look like?
Here's what you guys are going to do. This is the central...
Class is ending, and Brewer gives them some homework. He wants them to weigh Cuba's history as a probable sundown town against other evidence, like its previous location within the Underground Railroad that helped enslaved people to freedom.
Can you help us solve this mystery? Like, there's no consensus on it. Were we during the Great Migration? Were we part of the communities that welcomed people?
After class, junior Samantha Thumb is considering the question. She thinks Cuba may have been relatively welcoming.
I think compared to other places in Illinois, maybe we were, but I don't really know if really anybody was welcoming then, especially, like, you know, just white people. Like, at that time, it was just hard to find welcoming white people.
She says it's important to learn uncomfortable histories about race.
So if white people, for example, who have been the ones that put African Americans in that position, if they feel uncomfortable, then they won't want it to happen again. And so I think making them uncomfortable is kind of what prevents it from us making that mistake again.
So being uncomfortable is really important.
Yes.
You think it's a good thing.
Yes. I mean, you learn about the Holocaust in school, and of course it makes you uncomfortable just hearing about all the terrible things that happened to these people, these innocent people. Of course it's going to make you uncomfortable, but that's why we learn about it.
Illinois law also mandates that public schools teach Asian American and LGBTQ+ history. And starting this fall, teachers will have to cover one unit of Native American history. For Dialogue on Illinois Soul, I'm Emily Hayes reporting.
For more on this story and to see photos of Cuba High School, you can visit ipmnewsroom.org. If you want to get in touch with the Dialogue team, you can leave us a voicemail at 217-244-1989. Again, that's 217-244-1989. Or you can email us at illinoisoul@illinois.edu. We would love to connect with you on Instagram and Facebook. You can give us a follow at Illinois Soul. When Dialogue returns, we'll talk to a University of Illinois track star going for the gold at the Paris Olympic Games. We'll tell you why she's an international star from Africa. Stay tuned. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. The 2024 Paris Summer Olympics are finally here.
And the flame has been lit for the Paris Games.
We've already seen Team USA make a splash. Simone Biles was the first woman to land the Yurchenko double pike. Coco Gauff is the youngest American woman to win a singles match since Venus Williams. And Sha'Carri Richardson, she seeks to retain her title as the world's fastest woman. Right now, you'll be hearing from Rose Yeboah, an Olympian athlete and junior from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And this year, she will be attending the 2024 Paris Summer Olympic Games, representing Ghana in the high jump. We will hear this story from Illinois Public Media reporter Analika Ochuba. She sat down with Rose Yeboa and talked all things sports, what it's like being a U of I student, and her African culture.
Thank you so much for joining me today. So how did you end up as a student athlete at University of Illinois?
Oh, I was actually in University of Cape Coast, Ghana. That was where I was studying. And I got a scholarship here to study in U of I.
And so you just won the NCAA Division I Outdoor Championships in Oregon, which qualified you for the Olympic Games in Paris, which is absolutely awesome, by the way. Looking at, you know, your whole highlights from your career, absolutely awesome and just jaw-dropping. So can you walk me through your record-breaking jump that day? What was going on in your mind as you were about to, you know, take off?
Well, actually, before any start of a competition, like a day before the competition, like I already picture everything in mind, and I see it like I'm watching a television. So that day before the competition, I knew I was going to make it. I even told my assistant coach, Coach Sarah, that I'm gonna make it, because I had my 182 jump, I had it wrong on my first attempt. So I went to her to, figure it out what went wrong. I went and she told me, and I told her, there is still hope. I know I'm going to do it. So she motivated me, and that was what kept me going. And, like, the support alone is massive. Yeah.
You said, like, the support from your coaches?
Oh, yeah. I get a lot of support from them, like motivation and other stuff.
What do they say to you to kind of get you, you know, kind of gingered up, ready to go?
Every day, like, let me say, anytime we are competing, they make sure they are right by our side, even though they don't really allow the coaches to, come close to the jumping pit, but then they find a way that we can communicate with them whenever things go wrong, whenever we jump and they had to, correct something that went wrong during the after the jump. Yeah.
So how did your family react when they heard the news that you were going to the Olympics? And actually, can you tell me a little bit more about your family? Are they here? Are they still in Ghana?
Well, they were really happy. My family, they are in Ghana. They are in Kumasi, Ashanti. They are in the Ashanti region, Ghana. And they were really happy, of course. I told my brother, and I told him that I have qualified for the Paris Olympic. He said, oh yeah, he's really happy. He saw that on Facebook and other stuff. Like, people were posting it, commenting on it and other stuff. He saw it on Facebook, online. And they were happy. They were really happy. Yeah.
You said they're still in Ghana. How did they feel when, you know, you're leaving your country to go other side of the world to go be an athlete?
They were happy in a sense that, if your child is able to, engage in sports and they are supportive, they will push you harder. And my parents are really supportive. They are supportive in whatever I'm doing, my sports and other things. Because I know most of parents don't, like their athletes to, or their child to, engage in sports and other stuff. But for my parents, they make sure that my dream is being fulfilled. So they made everything possible for me to come here, even though it's not easy. Staying far away from your child or your parents and other things.
So tell me about your journey as a high jumper. What made you interested in the sport?
I was in junior high school in Fountain of Life International School in Tepa, in the Ashanti region, or in the Bunahafo region. So I was in this school and there was this competition coming on in Ghana. We call it like gala and other things, like, yeah, something like that. Inter-schools gala games and others.
Oh, so, like inter-house sports?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. So there was one, I didn't really want to, engage myself in it. So there was this one man, like one teacher by name, Sir Daniel, who, motivated me, told me to come and participate. By then, they were practicing on the field, and I just went there to, just watch. So he saw me and said, looking at how I am, like, I can jump. So I should come and try. So I told him, I don't want to try because I was afraid by then. So they were even using just raw, there were no mats and other stuff. They were using like two stands and they placed like a stick on it. And we were just jumping on it raw. So that was where I started picking up. And from there, I got a chance to go with the districts, Tepa districts, go with them to like certain competitions in like certain districts and other stuff. So I just got a scholarship to Kumasi Girls by the help of Selumo. He is also in Tepa. I got a transfer to Kumasi Girls through him, and I went there and I got to know Madame Joyce, Madame Florence, and there was one master too by name. We used to call him Aban. So it all started from there, where I went to Kumasi Girls, and I went there with the sports. So Madame Joyce took me through this high jump stuff, and I wasn't really good. Like, I was just jumping raw. I wasn't really good. So she saw that, like, maybe if she introduced me to something new, I can become a better person in future. So she told me that she's gonna introduce me to a certain techniques, and she hopes that the way I am jumping raw, like, and I'm jumping high, if she introduced that technique to me, I'm gonna jump more higher. So she did, and even though I wasn't really perfect, but I was trying. So she teach me, and I'm also a quick learner, so she taught me that, and I caught up with it quickly, and I took it from there. I then started competing in the inter-zonals competition, inter-school competitions, and I was winning a lot of medals for the school and for myself. And even though it wasn't only high jump that I was doing when I was in the senior high school, I was doing multiple events when I was in senior high school. But then I came to realize that Madame Joyce one time told me that I should concentrate more on high jump because it's an individual event, and it can really move me forward. So even though she told me that, but I was so interested in different games and different events. By then, I stick to her advice, and I got a national call up to represent my country in some certain competitions, both outside and both in the country as well. So that was where it all started from. And I competed in Morocco, you know, African Games in Morocco, where I came first. And I think that was where, like, most coaches saw me, yeah. So that's what happened.
Did you ever dream that you would be an Olympic athlete in your life?
Well, I would say yes. I would say no. I would say yes in the sense that even though I've dreamt of, qualifying for Olympic to represent my country, by then I would say no, because I know one day I will qualify for my country, but I wasn't expecting it like this sooner. Yeah, I wasn't really expecting it now, because I was just picking things up gradually, but I wasn't really expecting it though. Yeah.
How are you preparing for the games?
Well, I have another competition, so I'm still training with my coach here, and I have another competition, African Championships, which is coming on in Cameroon, from the 21st to 26th, something there about. And from there, I will just go back to Ghana and continue my training, even though my coach will be sending out workouts and other things for someone to have a different coach there to supervise me on that before they call for Olympic camp. Then I will just proceed to the camp.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Rose. Congratulations and good luck.
Bye. Thank you.
That was Illinois Public Media reporter Analika Ochuba speaking with Rose Yeboah, a junior from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's representing Ghana in the high jump for the 2024 Paris Summer Olympics. The Dialogue Show is produced by Nidhi Shastri, Penny Bradford, and myself, Kennedy Vincent. Our news and public affairs director is Reginald Hardwick, and production assistance by Steve Mork. Dialogue's theme song is by Lamont Holden. You can find Dialogue wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can give us a follow on Instagram and Facebook at Illinois Soul. Dialogue is a part of Illinois Soul and Illinois Public Media. Join us for our next Dialogue every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and Tuesday night at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul FM 101.1 and WILL AM 580 Wednesdays at 8 p.m.